corridors of Moonbase, shadowy in their nighttime lighting, toward the garage and the main airlock. For the first time since he'd been a boy, there were tears in his eyes.
"The last time I was on the moon ended unpleasantly," said Keiji Inoguchi.
"So?" replied Zimmerman coolly.
Inoguchi was a full head taller than Zimmerman, and gracefully slim. He seemed to glide rather than walk, totally unperturbed by the low lunar gravity.
"I worked at Nippon One 8 years ago," he told Zimmerman, "but I was sent back to Japan after being injured in an accident. Several of my ribs were broken."
Zimmerman nodded absently. Of the three UN inspectors sent up on the evacuation flight, Inoguchi seemed to be the only one who knew anything about nanotechnology. He claimed to be a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Kyoto, but to Zimmerman he seemed too young for a full professorship, unless he was actually working in a new field, uncluttered by tenured old men, a field such as nanotechnology. For 4 days, since the evacuation flight had touched down at Moonbase, Inoguchi and the two other UN inspectors had been making their methodical way through the nanolabs. Chris Cardenas had personally conducted their inspection tour, showing them everything, except Zimmerman's lab. Zimmerman stayed to himself behind locked doors, unwilling to allow UN Spionin to poke through his work. From what Cardenas told him, Inoguchi was bright, inquisitive, polite, and knowledgeable. The other two seemed to be out-and-out intelligence agents, ham-fisted and hard-eyed, looking for nanotech weapons without understanding what they might be. The inevitable happened late in the evening of their fourth day at Moonbase. Cardenas phoned Zimmerman, still barricaded in his lab, and warned him that Inoguchi was heading his way. Alone. Zimmerman heard a polite tap at his door almost before he clicked off the phone. Muttering to himself, he went to the door, determined to tell the interfering Japanese upstart that he had no business bothering the great Professor Zimmerman, and he should go away and stay away. Inoguchi bowed deeply as soon as Zimmerman slid the door open. "I am Keiji Inoguchi of the University of Kyoto," he said, staring at his shoes, not daring to look at Zimmerman. "I know it's an imposition, but I am required to ask you to allow me to inspect your laboratory." Grudgingly, Zimmerman waved the younger man into his lab. "It's an honor beyond my greatest expectations to actually meet you," Inoguchi said. His English was American-accented, and Zimmerman thought the man sounded sincere enough, even though he kept his face almost totally expressionless and still avoided making eye contact.
"Professor Cardenas tells me you appear quite knowledgeable," Zimmerman said gruffly. "Are you engaged in nanotechnology research at Kyoto?"
Inoguchi hesitated the merest fraction of a second, then replied,
"As you know, Professor, nanotechnology research is forbidden by law."
"Yeah, of course."
They stood just inside the doorway, Zimmerman blocking his visitor's further access into the lab, and spoke of many things, from the quality of students to the obtuseness of deans, without again mentioning nanotechnology. Despite their verbal sparring, or perhaps because of it, Zimmerman found that he enjoyed the younger man's company.
"How long will you remain at Moonbase?" Zimmerman asked.
"I wish I knew," Inoguchi replied wistfully. "Our mission to Moonbase was arranged very hastily, and with the blockade in effect."
"Blockade?"
"No flights to Moonbase have been permitted for 6 weeks now. Surely you were aware of that."
"Oh, that, yeah. I didn't think of it as a blockade," Zimmerman said.
With a rueful gesture, Inoguchi said,
"They told us back home before we left that they would try to arrange a mission from Nippon One to pick us up here and then bring us back to Copernicus. From there we can take a flight back to Earth. But I have no idea how long that will take to negotiate or how long I must remain here."
"I see.
One thing is certain, however. Even if there were 100 ships ready to take me back to Kyoto, I could not leave until I had looked through your laboratory."
Zimmerman grunted.
"You think I am cooking up nanomachines to wipe out Japan, maybe?"
Inoguchi actually broke into a grin.
"No, sir, I don't. But the people at the UN who sent me here fear that you might be brewing nanobugs that will spread deadly plagues all across Earth."
"Nonsense."
"You know it is nonsense, and I know it is nonsense. but they do not have enough knowledge to allay their fears."
Zimmerman looked at the younger man with newfound respect.
"Let us be frank with one another," Zimmerman said. "I will show you my work, but you must tell me about your own. Fair?"
Inoguchi nodded. "Quite fair."
"Your laboratory is funded by Yamagata Industries, I trust."
"My entire department is funded by Yamagata. Seigo Yamagata himself has taken a deep interest in my work."
"Which is?"
"Nanotechnology, of course. You must have known that."
Turning to lead him to the bench where the electron microscope and micromanipulators were, Zimmerman said over his shoulder,
"I had my suspicions."
Several hours later, they were sitting on stools at the back end of the lab, where Zimmerman kept his dwindling supply of imported beer. He had led his visitor through his whole lab, congratulating himself on not once letting him guess that his most recent work was all aimed at helping Moonbase to defend itself against Peacekeeper attack. Zimmerman took a long draught of beer from the plastic beaker he used as a stein.
"If the verdammt blockade continues much longer," he groused, "I will be reduced to drinking fruit juice."
Inoguchi said nothing.
"We've been trying to make beer with nanomachines, you know."
"Ah."
Shaking his head, Zimmerman confessed,
"It tastes like piss."
"Mr. Yamagata is most interested in the therapeutic uses of nanotechnology," Inoguchi said, holding his lab beaker of beer in both hands. "He is concerned about cancer, especially."
"So? How old is he?"
"Hardly 50, but the family history—"
"Professor Zimmerman, please report to the infirmary immediately," the wall speaker blared. "Professor Zimmerman to the infirmary at once. Emergency."
Day 42. Even nanomachines need a finite time to react. The virus-sized machines teeming in Doug's bloodstream sensed the sudden drop in pressure and the desperate chemical changes that tried to activate the natural clotting factors before Doug bled to death. His windpipe was cruelly ruptured, and blood was leaking into his lungs, choking him. Unconscious, gasping for breath, bleeding to death as his heart spewed his life's blood out through his severed arteries, Doug's hands spasmed, his body shuddered, and then he was still. Inside him, hundreds of millions of nanomachines were working with millisecond frenzy, seizing individual atoms and locking them in place like a stubborn team of men doggedly packing sandbags onto a flood-broken levee. With mindless purposefulness, other nanomachines pulled apart the droplets of blood leaking into Doug's lungs, broke up the liquid into molecules of gas. Doug coughed and retched as nanomachines seamlessly knitted together his carotid arteries and began to close the gash across his throat. Nearly half his blood had been splashed over the bunk, the wall, even the ceiling above the bunk before the nanomachines sealed his arteries and stopped the major bleeding. It took longer, minutes, to completely close the wound in his throat. Still unconscious, Doug sank into a deeper coma while the nanomachines cleaned his lungs and augmented the natural chemical factors that prompted his bone marrow to start producing more red blood cells. Yet his blood supply was dangerously depleted. He needed plasma and liquids. He lay there, between life and death, unable to move, unable to open his eyes, or stir himself out of the coma. Hours later, Edith came back to the apartment, tired yet keyed up with the excitement of having pulled off a masterful broadcast. "By golly, I am good," she told herself as she slid the door shut and started across the living room to see how Doug was doing. She screamed when she saw all the blood. Her knees buckled, and she felt as if she was going to faint.
"No!"
she raged at herself.
"Get help, quick!"
She banged on the phone keyboard and shrieked for an emergency medical team. Then she ran back to take a closer look at Doug.
Despite the blood, she saw no wounds, nothing but a thin red line across his throat.
It looked more like a paper cut than anything serious. Yet there was blood all over the bunk, soaking him, splattered on the wall, the ceiling. He was unconscious, totally out of it. He was breathing.